Hello, this is Justin Veach, Associate Director of Aloud, a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. You're about to hear Norman Davies, one of the world's preeminent scholars of World War II history, discuss his new book, No Simple Victory, Europe at War, 1939 to 1945. This program was originally produced on September 27, 2007. For more information on Aloud, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org.
It is indeed a great honor to welcome Norman Davies to the Los Angeles Public Library. Thank you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for those kind words. I'm very pleased to be back in Los Angeles. I first came here, I think, 30 years ago when I was about so big. In case some of you think I have a rather large tumor on the chest, I was looking at myself in the mirror behind there, waiting for the introduction to finish. I have a wireless mic here in my pocket, and I shall try and cover it by my arms. I'm here to introduce my latest book, No Simple Victory. The British edition was called Europe at War, 1939-45, and there's a subtitle, No Simple Victory. And the American publishers in New York decided to turn it round, and they've made it into No Simple Victory, World War II in Europe. And I think that's right and proper. I prefer it that way round. Some of you will have seen the TV series, or the beginning of the TV series, The War, directed by Ken Burns. I've not seen it, although I did see an interview with Ken Burns when I was in New York last week, and heard him explaining what he was aiming to do by expanding history from the bottom up. History as seen through the experiences and the reminiscences of American veterans who took part in the war, and of course in the war effort at home. I rather like that introduction. I could see that he knew what he was doing, and I myself have advocated this sort of approach to military history, which always used to be taught from the top down. Namely, the historians imagined that they were the generals sitting with their maps and they were moving the armies around, and the poor guys who were actually doing the fighting hardly got a say in the story. However, Burns's series, like many others, is exclusively confined to the American perspective, to that part of the Second World War in which the US took part. And my book, and what I shall say this evening, is about the other 80% of the story, certainly in Europe, in which neither the British or the Americans had any prominent part. And the proportions of the war, especially in Europe, are especially important. I know that here in LA, we're on the shores of the Pacific, and that the war was fought in two theaters, in the Pacific and in Europe. And the US had a especially difficult task in fighting these two separate wars at the same time. I was in Harvard last week, and in one of the commentaries after my presentation, Professor Richard Pipes got up and spoke, and one of the things he said that for us, meaning the Americans, the war against Japan was the more important. I imagine that is how you see it here in Los Angeles, and I wouldn't disagree. However, because of the great burden of the Pacific War, the American participation in Europe was much smaller than is usually allowed for. And I hope to give some facts and figures which will back that up. Before I go any further, I'm going to ask you three questions. I won't provide the answers, which are a bit tricky, but in case you want to go to sleep when I continue to drone on, you can at least think about these questions. The first one is about battles, the biggest and most decisive battles of the war in Europe. Where in that long list of big and decisive battles would you put Operation Overlord, i.e. D-Day and the Normandy landings? Do you think that would be the largest battle or the most decisive? Or would it be number two? Or would it be number three? Or number four? Number five? Just think where it is on that scale of size and importance. The second question, can you name the largest concentration camp that was operating in Europe in 1939 to 45? Simple question. The third one, not so simple. Can you name the nationality which lost the largest number of civilians in the war in Europe? I'll move on. I won't give you any hints. Briefly about the war itself. The war went through three phases, 1939 to 41, 41 to 44, and then the final phase in from June 1944 until the end in May 1945. And I'll try and say a word about each. But I'll start, as one should do, with the beginning, the outbreak of the war in September 1939. Not incidentally, as almost all Russians would say, and many Americans, not in 1941. The war started on the 1st of September 1939 at 4:45 in the morning, when the German army crossed the frontiers of Poland. And a few days later, the Red Army crossed the eastern frontier of Poland, and the two invaders met in the middle. However, before that, the war was only made possible by a secret agreement between these two largest combatant powers, the Third Reich and the Soviet Union. 23rd of August 1939, the German Foreign Minister Robert von Ribbentrop flew to Moscow and signed what we know as the Nazi-Soviet Pact and its secret protocols. And essentially, this was an arrangement where the two parties, not just one party, not just Hitler, the two parties would not interfere with each other when they attacked their respective neighbors. This is important because the conventional story has it that the Soviet Union, the biggest combatant power of them all, was neutral. It wasn't neutral. Stalin participated in the initial agreement that made the war possible, and he participated in some of the biggest campaigns at the beginning of the war. We even know what Stalin had in mind in signing the Nazi-Soviet Pact. The agenda, the minutes of a meeting of the Politburo on the 19th of August 1939 are now known. And essentially, Stalin was calculating that if he made this arrangement with Hitler, Hitler would become embroiled with the Western powers. There would be a war in the West in which the capitalist enemy, as he saw it, would, the capitalist rivals, the Third Reich and France and Britain, would be caught up in a long war. They would slog it out, and the Soviet Union would benefit by not being involved and would then be able to exploit the situation. In other words, from the start, the Soviet Union was engaged, and in the first place, Stalin and Hitler were in agreement that the Western powers, the democracies, should be removed from the scene before anything else happened. Now, the first phase of the war I began to talk about, 39 to 41. In those 2 years, the Germans attacked 8 countries in all, and Stalin, the Soviet Union, attacked 5 countries. Generally speaking, Hitler was far more successful than Stalin. Poland was knocked out in 1939. In May, June 1940, in a similar period of time, both Britain and France were knocked out of the reckoning. And Hitler was far more successful than his wildest dreams might have led him to believe. Stalin, on the other hand, met with catastrophe. The Red Army invaded Finland. If ever you want to disprove the story that the Soviet Union was neutral in the first place, more than 1 million men were poured into Finland, and the Red Army took a beating. Little Finland didn't collapse. It kept fighting throughout the winter of 39 to 40, and it only was made to accept a peace after Easter in 1940, when the sheer numbers began to tell. In those years, end of 39, 40, 41, Hitler and Stalin were working together. The Soviet Union was supplying oil for the Wehrmacht in the West. The two sides were exchanging prisoners. The Gestapo was handing over people that that Stalin's regime wanted, Ukrainians and so on, and Stalin was handing over German communists for the Gestapo to deal with. It was not a formal alliance, but a partnership. Everything changed, however, in the second phase, June 1941, when the two partners jumped at each other's throats. The Germans invaded the Soviet Union, not incidentally Russia. Russia was 1,000 miles from where that war began. And there started the biggest military conflict in European history, if not in world history. The German-Soviet war on the Eastern Front was many times greater than any of the other campaigns of the war, in fact, of all the other campaigns of the war put together. 80%, according to German records, 80% of German losses were inflicted in the East. And the implication is that there was only 20% of the German losses to be accounted for by the Western powers. And at a rough guess, I think the British might claim 5%, the Americans might claim 10 or 15%. But this is the, of course, in crude numbers, the proportions of the of the East and the West. The third phase comes after 3 years when the German army is already, if not defeated, is retreating and is in serious trouble. The Western armies land in Normandy at a time when in the summer of 1944, the Red Army is already poised to attack Berlin. We know of a document, a plan submitted to Stalin by his two leading marshals, Rokossovsky and Zhukov. It's the 8th of August, 1944, to capture Warsaw and to drive straight for Berlin. We know that Stalin didn't accept it, although we don't know for certain why. But my guess is that Stalin realized he'd so much time to spare over the Western armies in the coming from the opposite direction that he could spend the next 5 or 6, 7 months conquering all the countries of Eastern Europe before the British and the Americans even began to come over the horizon. And that's what he did. It's also true that the Western armies made much slower progress than expected. They broke out of Normandy at the end of July 1944. They didn't cross the Rhine, you know, the famous bridge at Remagen, into the center of Germany until March 1945. In other words, this is 8 months. It took them 8 months to cross France and get into Germany. And in that time, Stalin had overrun half the continent. And it was only at a very late stage, in April 1945, that the Americans and the Soviets came together on the Elbe. The finale came as a surprise, I think, to everybody. The expectation had been that the armies of East and West would pincer the Reich from either side and then would join together and crush the life out of the fascist beast, as the saying went. That didn't happen. At the last moment, in March 1945, when the battle for Berlin was looming, General Eisenhower decided that United States troops would not take part. The reason for this was fairly obvious. It was Japan. The Americans couldn't afford to lose hundreds of thousands of men storming Berlin because these men were needed in the East. In other words, the Western powers had joined too late with too little forces to play the decisive role. I nowhere say that their participation was insignificant, but the proportions are clear. In military terms, it was the Red Army that won the war in Europe, and not the Western democracies. And the final showdown in Berlin was performed by the Red Army alone. And they were willing, through Stalin's ruthless approach, to lose 300,000 men in that one battle, i.e. more men than the British and the Americans lost in Europe in the whole of the war. That's just a quick narrative. Let me talk now briefly about three key words that we mention. One is victory. What do we mean by victory? One is military triumph, the defeat of the enemy. And there's no doubt our enemy, the Third Reich, was defeated. It was finished off. But in other fields, such as the political field, there was no clear victory. The Soviet Union was as hostile to Western democracy as the Third Reich had been. And at the end of the war, it wasn't democracy that triumphed. It was, an impasse. Democracy triumphed in one half of Europe, and Stalinist communism, mass murdering tyranny, triumphed in the other half. And there's also this moral aspect of victory. If a mass murdering tyranny achieves the prime result at the end of the war, then you can't say that freedom, justice, and democracy triumphed, because they didn't. They half triumphed, but the real victor was, in Europe at least, Stalin and Stalin's hateful system. And this brings me to the second key word, the good war. Very popular, I'm sure it will be repeated very often in Ken Burns' series. The war can be seen as a good war if you simply look at that sector in which we were involved. But if you take the bigger picture, the war is not between good and evil, or guys fighting for freedom and liberation. The war is being fought between two colossal tyrannical monsters tearing the guts out of each other on the Western Front. And irrespective of which of them had won, there would have been no good result, because neither Hitlerism or Stalinism would fit the category of a good victor triumphing over evil. And lastly, liberation. How often do we hear that Europe was liberated? Europe was half liberated. And I would suggest less than half liberated. Let me try give you one graphic example, and then I'll ask for questions. We've all seen the terrible, in some ways, hopeful pictures of the liberation of Auschwitz. Handful of survivors, among them lots of children, twins. You've probably seen these terrible pictures of the twins that have been kept alive for experiments, crowding up to the barbed wire, filmed by Red Army cameramen who had just broken into the camp. That was undoubtedly a liberation. No two ways about it. However, what was going on at the same time? Those Red Army soldiers who liberated Auschwitz were fighting the surface of a regime which had bigger concentration camps than Auschwitz, and a system of camps which had started a lot earlier and went on a lot longer. So what sort of liberation was it? Cohort of prisoners, if they survive, was released to be replaced by others. Several of the Nazi concentration camps were used by Stalin's police at the end of the war to collect new people who were to be taken out of circulation. And to my mind, this is is symptomatic of the overall situation in Europe. It's a bit complicated. There was a process of liberation going on simultaneously as a process of enslavement. And that's the reason why I call my book No Simple Victory. Thank you. I will. The light's in my face. Yes, sir, I can. I believe it was in the 1970s, it's about 30 years ago, and to be fair, it wasn't the BBC, it was ITV, i.e. the independent television channel, but it came out of London, I agree. I don't think that series has been bettered. It was very comprehensive, I think that series showed the Eastern Front more fully than anything before or since. I can't remember in detail all the many episodes. There were something like, was it 30 or 35 episodes? It was a huge, huge undertaking. Yes, you know, if I had to recommend a television series, that's what it would be. But even so, on this question of balance, I think you'll find it in that series. The impression is given is that the Western powers and the Soviet Union in the East joined forces, and together they crushed the Third Reich. That's true, but the implication is that it's sort of 50-50. And I'm suggesting that the balance is rather less than 50-50. And one can talk for ages. What was the impact of the Western bombing offensive, for example? There was no equivalent in the East, or the question of intelligence, or the war at sea, and all these things. But however you add up the balance, it seems to me that the true victor of the war was in the East, and the victor was up to no good. So.
You mentioned the extent of the German losses in the East. Why do you think that the Germans chose to follow Napoleonism when invading Russia as opposed to attacking the British areas in the Mediterranean and Middle East?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't think there's much puzzle about that. The Soviet Union was the biggest military power, certainly in numbers. It had by far the biggest army from the beginning, about four times as big as the American army in Europe, incidentally. It was thought to be very poorly organized, and the general expectation was in 1941 that the Red Army won't last for more than a few weeks. So it was very tempting. In order to win domination of the whole of Europe, which is obviously what Hitler was aiming at, he had to knock out the biggest rival, and that was the Soviet Union. He'd already almost knocked out the United Kingdom. We were hanging on by our fingernails. We'd lost all offensive capacity. We had a big navy, but you can't invade Germany with a battleship. We had an air force which performed extremely well in 1940, but it was a long time before we were able even to drop bombs on Germany in an effective way. The biggest adversary for the Third Reich was always going to be the Soviet Union. There was no other way to supremacy without the Germans destroying that. Yes, sir, on this side.
We know that Stalin agitated for a second front with Churchill and Roosevelt. Do you think that without it, the Germans would have won in the East?
Would the Germans have won? No, the Germans had already essentially lost in the East by the time that the Second Front was established. The first timetable that was drawn up foresaw a Second Front in 1943. We weren't able to fulfill that promise. And it's in 1943, first with Stalingrad, which was a sort of great psychological victory, the first time the Wehrmacht was soundly beaten. And then, second, the Battle of Kursk, which I think is the key battle of the war, where the Red Army destroyed the Germans' tank force. After that, the Wehrmacht was incapable of mounting a major offensive again. And that was all over by the summer of 1943. From then on, the Soviets were heading for Berlin, and the various things the Western powers were doing were not insignificant, but were not key to that central operation. Sir, yes, at the back.
I agree with your conclusions about Russia.
Yeah.
Being the primary victor in Europe, how much did American Lend-Lease contribute toward that victory?
Thank you. In the field of military supplies and production and so on, there were two miracles. One was in the United States, which from quite a low starting point produced this colossal, munificent torrent of goods which went to all the Allies. The other miracle was in the Soviet Union, which many of the prime industrial areas of the Soviet Union, particularly in Ukraine, were overrun in 1941. And so large numbers of Soviet factories had to be moved, lock, stock, and barrel, with all their equipment, all their people, thousands of miles in some cases, to Siberia, to the Kuzbass, or to the Urals, and so on. And yet they succeeded in producing huge numbers of very good tanks, very good guns, Katyusha rockets. And that Soviet miracle was producing effects before Lend-Lease really began to bite. In military terms, the critical moment was in the summer of 1943. And American Lend-Lease, important though it was, only really came on full stream in 43 to 44. So, and this is an ironic conclusion you can contemplate on your way home. American Lend-Lease probably was decisive in enabling Stalin to run overrun Eastern Europe in 1944 to 1945, but not to fight the key battles, the Battle of Warsaw and Battle of Moscow, December 41, Stalingrad, Kursk in 42. Yeah. Ironically, but that's how I think it was. Gentleman at the back, yes. Has anybody thought of the answers to the three questions yet?
I just have one question to ask you about the role of Russia or the Soviet Union in the United States' goal of defeating the Japanese.
Yeah.
Obviously, it was in the U.S.'s interest to keep, until the atomic bomb, to keep Russia to the fire in terms of invading the Japanese for us.
Right.
So that, yes, we may have decided not to lose troops fighting a useless fight against a very powerful enemy that had already taken over Eastern Europe, because we needed the Soviet Union, we thought, to conquer Japan.
Yeah. I would strongly agree with that analysis. My friends from Eastern Europe are always bitterly complaining that they were sold down the river at Yalta to Stalin. And I, in a very real sense, I think they were. But the prime concern of Roosevelt in his last months was to ensure that Soviet manpower would be transferred to the Far East. The Americans, as you know, before the atom bomb was known to work, were expecting to lose 1 million lives in the final attack against the Japanese islands. And the only aid and assistance to them in that terrible task was the Red Army. So when Stalin agreed to participate in the war against Japan, he agreed at Yalta. Once he'd done that, Roosevelt was not going to argue about Eastern Europe or other things which in the American interests were definitely secondary. Of course, if you came from Eastern Europe, you had a different view. The gentleman at the back.
This is the first time I thought of it. I've always been told that France and England joined, declared the war against Germany because Germany invaded Poland. Why didn't they declare war against Russia if Russia invaded at the same time?
Very good question, and I have talked to the late Sir Frank Roberts, who was the British diplomat in 1939, who had the job of talking to the Polish ambassador, who came to him on the 17th of September and said, Great Britain has guaranteed Poland's independence. You declared war against Germany when Germany invaded. You will now please declare war against the Soviet Union, which is invaded from the east. And the answer was, typical British deviousness, guaranteed Poland's independence, but not her frontiers. It's like the president of Iran, isn't it? You know? Very slippery. Yes, lady.
How much, if any, credit would you give to Soviet military strategy during World War II in accounting for their victory, or is it simply a matter of the huge volume of soldiers and manpower that they had that enabled them to win?
Yes, thank you. It's an important point because the professional assessment of the Red Army at the beginning of the war is that all it had is numbers. Was thought to have substandard equipment, poor training. Stalin had been shooting his generals, as you know, something 75% of the higher officers were killed at the beginning of the war. You know, how could an outfit really pull itself together? And yet it did. And I think it's simply wrong to say that you'll note I never use the word Russia, because the Russians were only 55% of this outfit. The Soviets did have the numbers. They had something like 400 divisions, as opposed to less than 100 in the U.S. Army. The British fielded 28 divisions. You know? The Germans had 230. And you can say some divisions were bigger than others, but the numbers are just colossal. They had a huge advantage of numbers. And, of course, they weren't squeamish at losing them. They quite deliberately use men to clear minefields. They calculated in cold blood that they would lose 3 soldiers for every German soldier they killed and still come out on top. And it was quite clear that was how they operated. They shot, can you imagine this statistic? They shot more of their own soldiers in order to encourage the others than the British Army lost in the whole of the Western campaign. You see that this frightening machine, but it was effective. But it wasn't only effective because of numbers. They had excellent equipment. You know, to everybody's amazement, the Soviet Union produced the best tank of the war. The T-34 could stand up to the tank, the Panzers, whereas the Shermans and the Churchills couldn't. They produced wonderful guns. The Russian Empire had a long tradition of artillery, wonderful. These Katyusha rockets, probably the most effective offensive field weapon of the war. They produced rather good aeroplanes. They lost, I think it's true, more aeroplanes in 1941 than the whole of the British Air Force in total. And yet they recovered, and by the end of the war, they were producing rather good warplanes of their own. So they also had rather good generals, which is not a small consideration. If you look at the generals of the Second World War, I think there's only General Patton on the Western side, which would be in the first class. There's half a dozen of these Soviet generals. Look at Rokossovsky, right? He was in the Gulag in 1939. It was absolute miracle that he survived. He actually spent 4 years in the Gulag. Most people only survive for one winter. And he was brought out of the Gulag. He was sent to the Crimea for 6 weeks to get a few vitamins in him. And then he was sent to the front. And he performed miracles. In one operation of which you've probably never heard, Operation Bagration, in the spring of 1944, Rokossovsky destroyed, and I mean destroyed, more than 50 German divisions. That's the equivalent of the entire German deployment on the Western Front. Where? Belarusia. Okay, it's when the Soviet army already had the advantage, and they pulverized the central section of the German lines. We hardly notice that. Answer to the first question I gave you. D-Day isn't even in the top 10 battles. Like, it's just not on the scale. Yes?
Question. Going back to the invasion of the Soviet Union by the Germans, the histories say that Stalin was incapacitated during the first part of the invasion. Is this correct, or was it an attempt to draw the Germans into the interior of Russia?
The short answer is I don't know.
He was incapacitated.
He disappeared. The usual explanation is that he had a nervous breakdown. What that means, I don't know, whether he was ill. It's very unlikely that in a system where, in a dictatorship where the top man decides everything of importance, that in a situation where the country is being invaded, that he would pull out for a week or two to take a rest, you know? It's just highly unlikely. So it's also, I think, a bit fantastic to think that this was a very clever ploy to let the world think that he'd been beaten. No, but I don't know. I've not seen any detailed analysis of that. But there are, incidentally, lots of archives in now in Russia, which Soviet archives, which had never been looked at. I had a go in Moscow, and I find a few things that I wanted, but the usual response was, yet, no. So, it's...
Right here, sir. First of all, I want to thank you very much for an incredibly informative lecture.
Mm-hmm.
I would hope that every American history teacher the high school level would use a lot of the information you offered us this evening. Because most American kids feel that we won the war. They know nothing about what Russia contributed. You point out 80% of the losses on the side mm-hmm. of the Germans were inflicted by the Russians on the Eastern Front.
The Soviets, yeah.
I'd also like to point out something. A young kid in the Navy during World War II, in the Pacific, in June of 1944, operating up and down the New Guinea coast as part of MacArthur's fleet, before we headed north to the Philippines. We knew very little about the invasion. It didn't mean a damn thing to us. It was way the hell over that way, and we were fighting a war in the Pacific, never knowing when we'd ever get home again. If it hadn't been for dropping the A-bomb, I think it would have been out there for another year. As you pointed out, the American military establishment estimated about 1 million American casualties. You mentioned 1 million dead. Maybe that's over and above what they figured. But they figured if we ever had to go into Japan, the guys who were in Europe when the war had ended were slated to go to the Pacific. When they found out that we dropped the A-bomb, and then when Japan surrendered, they thanked God that we had done that. There's still many Americans wonder, why did we drop the A-bomb? Why couldn't we continue a normal war and then defeat the Japanese?
Mm-hmm. You've answered the question, thank you, yes. the lady, yes.
Could you speak a little bit about the Katyn, is his name right, massacre, and I'm not sure, what year was it? It was...
1940.
So why was it, in the midst of this, at that point, the Poles were technically the allies of the Russians?
No.
No, not at all? They were, but how they took the time to kill all the Polish cavalry, all the Polish officers in the midst of their needs for, yeah. you know... their aggression elsewhere.
Okay. This, to me, is one of the really troubling episodes of the war, not only because it was a horrific massacre. Can you imagine what the world would think if 25,000 American officers had been murdered in cold blood? The world would know about it. These men happened to be Polish officers. They were our allies. At the beginning of the war, the United States was not involved. And for 45 years until Gorbachev came along and provided the documents and said, yes, this was the work of Stalin's police, the Western world didn't want to know. And this is another thing about the good war. This is something that happened to an Allied army. Let me explain the circumstances. Poland is a square. It's invaded from the west by the Germans and from the east by the Soviets. It's divided down the middle, and the Wehrmacht and the Red Army hold a joint victory parade. Have you ever seen pictures of that? There's a film of it, but they don't show it because it's so embarrassing to the whole Allied cause. Okay. Both sides take huge numbers of Polish prisoners. The Germans, for whatever reason, treat their Polish prisoners, military prisoners, quite well. They put them in regular prisoner of war camps. and almost all those guys survived the war. On the other side, in the Soviet Union, Stalin's police round up more than 250,000 prisoners. They pick out the officers and they shoot them in cold blood. The guys that committed that crime, we know who their names are. They're old men now, but some of them are still alive in Moscow, and nobody has thought of, well, the Poles think of it, but nobody can persuade the Russians even to treat this as a crime. It took 45 years for most of the mass graves to be found, but one mass grave with 4,500 bodies was found by the Germans in 1943 when they were occupying the Western Soviet Union. And of course, Goebbels then made a great song of dance, showed these pictures and said, this is what the Soviet Union does. It was one occasion when Goebbels didn't lie. He didn't have to lie. But the whole of the Western world said, Nazi propaganda, of course this crime was committed by the SS. It wasn't. And this is a moral problem that the Soviet Union, who became our ally and was responsible for, primarily for the defeat of the Third Reich, was guilty of crimes of that, of many such crimes, only one. It looks to me, and this is in the field of speculation because nobody has found the relevant documents in Germany, but the SS and Stalin's police were partners. And there were meetings in Poland where they coordinated tactics. And the Nazis, of course, had a policy not only to kill Jews, but to kill the entire educated intelligentsia of Poland. And it looks as though Stalin had the same idea, because at exactly the same period, this is March and April 1940, the SS started rounding up Polish professors, teachers, doctors, priests, that sort of people, and shooting them in cold blood, including my father-in-law, who was sent to Dachau. And at the same time, Stalin's police were rounding up these people who we now see as the victims of Katyn. Incidentally, 11,000 of those victims were civilians. Everybody says officers, but a lot of the people that were killed were lawyers, teachers, professors, that sort of people. Terrible episode. As I say, not because in Stalin's scale shooting 25,000 people was the biggest item on the agenda, but because it's been denied for so long. And it's here.
Given what you've said about the state of the British military and the need for the United States to concentrate largely on the Pacific, can you come up with a different scenario that would have produced a different result?
All I can say is that various scenarios were floating around. The most obvious one was that the Second Front should have been started earlier. But the British and the Americans had a very particular problem which the Soviets didn't have, and that is that Their only remaining base was on an island called Great Britain. Not England, incidentally, like the Soviet Union wasn't Russia. And in order to conduct any operation, whether it was the first Operation Torch in North Africa or then Sicily or the Normandy, a huge amphibious force of ships, aeroplanes, and ground troops had to be assembled. And this, the logistics of that were mind-boggling. And I think there was this technical reason why the Western powers were inhibited in performing effectively or as early as obviously they wanted to do. The other consideration is that for the United States forces to come to Britain in the first place, the Atlantic Ocean had to be cleared of U-boats. And it took until the summer of May 1943 is the date when the Battle of the Atlantic was turned. The U-boats were never completely defeated, but the sea lanes were open from then on for American convoys and troop ships to come over, and of course couple of million men came over. Before that, they couldn't do it. And that's exactly the time when the Red Army was beating the stuffing out of the Wehrmacht in the East. So, you had your hand up earlier. Have I answered your question by mistake?
Thank you.
Yeah.
No, I just wanted to, many of your historians, they don't go further back. And I'm wondering, when I was a little boy, I remember the war in Spain. It was between the Loyalists and, I don't know, it was Franco, mm-hmm. or whatever. And it seemed that the Germans came on one side and our sympathies was with another. And I'm just wondering, they don't even teach this to kids anymore. They don't even know what I'm talking about.
Right.
When you're talking about the Franco, the Spanish War.
The Spanish Civil War,
Civil War, yes.
Well, thank you. That's a critical episode in my mind. Franco was a fascist. He rebelled against the Spanish Republic, and the Civil War was nicely balanced for a long time, for 3 years. Hitler sent reinforcements to the fascists, and Stalin, of course, sent aid and assistance to the Republic. In fact, at the very end, Stalin's people took over the Spanish Republic. And to my mind, this was the period where people in Europe, but in the world in general, were trying to weigh up which is the bigger menace. You've got these foul fascists on one hand, and you've got these foul communists on the other side. They're both meddling in international affairs. Which do we regard as the main enemy? And my guess is that if the Spanish Republic, dominated by 1939 by communists, had won the war, the world would have said, these are the prime enemies of civilization. These are the big threat. But it went the other way. Franco and his fascists won, and the Western world then said, these are the guys we've got to oppose. So you're quite right, a critical period.
We have time for maybe two or three more questions.
Yes.
Yes, you seem to have not spoken anything about Mussolini and Italy. Where do they sort of fit in the puzzle?
Well, I like Italy, so... Mussolini in fact, possessed a rather large army, a powerful navy, which was the premier naval force in the Mediterranean, an army. The trouble was the Italians didn't want to fight for him. Unlike Germany, where the nation kept fighting right to the bitter end, it's evident that the Italians had no stomach for the various mad designs that Mussolini had for them. So the result was the Italians played a much smaller part in the whole story than they might otherwise have done. I only have a minute to say it, but that's how I think it was a question of morale, not a question of numbers or preparation or training or whatever. In the First World War, the Italians performed brilliantly, with great resolution and courage. But in the Second World War, they didn't. A tragic story, you know. The Italian Mussolini sent large number, several hundred thousand, of Italian soldiers to the Eastern Front. And when Mussolini was deposed in 1943, the Italian army stopped fighting in the East. The SS rounded them up and shot them. One of the, as it were, touchstones of these totalitarian powers is how they treat their allies. No compunction of the SS of shooting their own allies, but Stalin was the same. Do you know that Stalin murdered 4 million of his own men at the end of the war? These are men who'd been... I'm sorry, I say 4 million. There were 5 million Soviet soldiers who were prisoners in Germany. The SS didn't even put them in concentration camps. They just held them in the open until they started eating each other. And then they recruited some of them for concentration camp guards. You don't think any of these guys were volunteers in the normal sense. And by 1945, only 1 million of those 5 million were still alive. They were then taken back to the Soviet Union, and Stalin shot or killed in the gulag all the people that had survived the SS camps. Can you get your head around that one? People say, what had they done? They'd been abroad, that was enough. So, yes.
Considering the invasion of Norway,
If the French and the British had come earlier into Norway, could they have stopped the German advance?
Ifs and buts, you know. Historians are concerned with what actually happened, and we know that. The British and French, and of course a couple of Polish divisions went in there, but it was too late, too little. But there's another consideration. The Germans had a great advantage on the continent. The British and the French would have to have supplied this. If they'd established their bridgehead, you know, the supply, the ships would have had to come across the North Sea, and it's doubtful whether they could have held on to that for any length of time. But stranger things happen. One of the essential things of this war, as almost any war, is that surprising things happen. You know, people make calculations, generals make plans, and almost always they go wrong. and there are consequences, unforeseen consequences of events, and you get these strange results which weren't foreseen and are sometimes hard to believe when you actually read what's happened. Well, I've had several on this side. All right then, sir, yes, at the back.
One last question. Did you see the movie Downfall, and what did you think of it?
I didn't, unfortunately. But I heard I've seen one or two clips, and the actor playing Hitler was brilliant and was very convincing. And there was this wonderful comment that that actor made Hitler seem too human. Well, he was human. Alas. Alas, you know, that's humankind. It comes in all sorts. What is...
Do you like history in a movie, or do you
not feel like... I think any medium, from poetry to films to novels to anything which conjures up the spirit of some period or event is most welcome. What is killing are these dry as dust accounts where, as it were, humanity isn't suffering and triumphing. You know, there's the emotional element which is so important in war is absent. In, as it were, our Western stereotypes, all our negative emotion of what was nasty, horrible, evil is poured into Hitler and the Third Reich for obvious reasons. And I sometimes wish that the picture was a bit bigger. Stalin was an evil monster, and he didn't make as many mistakes as Hitler did. You know his famous comment that Anthony Eden, the British Foreign Secretary, went to Moscow in 1941 to begin the attempts to form the Grand Alliance, and he had Stalin in a room, as it were, where they could talk in private, and he said, Mr. Stalin, do you mind telling me how many people were killed in the Soviet Union in the 1930s? And Stalin looked at him and he said, I don't know, perhaps 10 million, but you have to know when to stop.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay at Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KCET, and LA 36. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.